You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Russian Dolls, The West Fairy Tale Fetish is Rooted in Capitalist Fantasy by Rachel Dodds, with an opening illustration by Bill Donovan, which shows models walking down a red carpet and emerging from a carriage drawn by horses, and the carriage is shaped like a Russian decorated egg. You perhaps already know the story of supermodel Lena Permanova. In case not, here's a summary. When she was a teenager, Permanova was facing 6 years in a Siberian prison for selling ecstasy at Russian nightclubs under her dad, until her dad asked Alexander Lebedev, a former KGB operative turned billionaire, for his help in her case. He helped, and by the time she was 18, Permanova and Lebedev, 27 years her senior, had fallen in love. A Cinderella story was the Harper's Bazaar headline. 20 years later, Permanova is a mother of four, philanthropist, and world-renowned fashion influencer with 2.4 million Instagram followers, an insta-hero, as Tatler magazine put it. Other Russian models have followed a similar arc. Irina Shayk was heralded as the coal miner's daughter in the pages of V-Man magazine, going from life as a simple farm girl in nowhere Russia to a global celebrity. By nowhere, they meant Emelyansk, a small village close to the Kazakhstan border, where Shayk planted potatoes in her garden until she was discovered one fateful day. She became the first Russian featured on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, and later had a baby with Bradley Cooper. Natalia Vodianova's incredible career trajectory, from selling fruit on the streets of Nizhny Novgorod to becoming the face of Calvin Klein and marrying a British aristocrat whom she has since divorced, earned her the nickname Supernova. Her star still burns bright. In 2020, she married Antoine Arnault, son of one of the richest men in Europe. Sasha Pivovarova was an art student in Moscow who didn't aspire to be part of the fashion industry until her photographer boyfriend, now husband, sent her a picture to IMG. She opened the Prada show 2 weeks later. "It's hard to imagine a more meteoric rise," gushed the website The Fashionography. "Is it really? Since the early 2000s, when Vladimir Putin came to power and transferred vast quantities of wealth into the hands of loyal Kremlin-linked oligarchs, beautiful women from Russia and former Soviet bloc countries have been branded with a strikingly similar narrative. A Cinderella story in which capitalism arrives as Prince Charming. Strange as it may seem to think that there are trends in human beings, there was a moment in the early aughts, around the time George W. Bush looked Putin in the eye to get a sense of his soul, when it felt like runways were a continuous parade of tall, thin, and steely-eyed Russians, with names like Vlada, Natasha, and Irina, following in the footsteps of Natalia. At the same time, wealthy Russian shoppers began populating those front rows. By 2012, the New York Times style section declared that the Tsarinas are back, in a piece about how Russians were becoming designers' most important couture clients in a generation. We are primed to devour these rags-to-riches stories because they seem ripped right from the pages of Russian literature. Who among us hasn't been moved by the doomed passion of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, the ill-fated extravagance of Chekhov's Lyubov Andreyevna, or the tragic sensuality of Dostoevsky's Nastasya Filipovna? On TV, we were delighted by the seduction of beautiful KGB agent Elizabeth Jennings, Carrie Russell, by the West on the Americans. In The Great, Hulu's comedic reinterpretation of the life of Catherine the Great, we scoffed at the debauchery of Imperial Russia while rooting for our heroine, Elle Fanning, to overthrow her boorish husband and unleash the Enlightenment across the land. On and off the fashion runways, the luxury-clad women were in most cases unwitting props in a narrative that put a glamorous spin on Putin's global kleptocracy, allowing him to cultivate the image of a leader restoring Russia to its former glory, even as the money backing him was undermining democracies around the world. The fetishization of Russian women extended beyond the fashion industry, of course. We need look no further than rhythmic gymnast Alina Kabaeva, hailed by The Guardian as one of the new Russian divas in 2007. Raised in Tashkent in northern Uzbekistan, Kabaeva was reportedly deemed to be too fat for gymnastics until a notoriously tough coach put her on what she has described as a near-starvation diet and an intense training regimen, which earned her Olympic gold, the title of Russia's most flexible woman, and, following her retirement, a parliamentary seat in the State Duma and a reported $10 million a year job atop a pro-Kremlin media company. By 2011, she was on the cover of Russian Vogue wearing a gold Balmain gown and fending off continuing rumors that she was Putin's girlfriend. Recently, she was reported to be holed up in a Swiss chalet with her four children, believed to be fathered by Putin. Putin refuses to speak about his private life. When Russia invaded Ukraine in late February a year ago, Milan Fashion Week happened to be underway. As a result, runway models, both Russian and Ukrainian, were some of the earliest and most visible critics of the war. Ukrainian model Kristi Panomar held a Prada bag as she gave Putin the middle finger in an Instagram post on the day of the invasion. Another Ukrainian model, Katerina Zub, protested outside the Dolce & Gabbana show holding her country's flag. Vodianova posted links to charities and wrote on her Instagram that my heart goes out to all mothers who are suffering the consequences of recent events in Ukraine, but was called out by commenters for not explicitly saying the word war. Shaikh, in contrast, posted a peace sign and said no to war, but closed the comments. Vlada Rosliakova, who identifies as a supermodel and Siberian princess in origin on her Instagram account, posted a video of herself singing a Russian song. Permanova posted in an all-black square on her grid with a broken heart emoji saying in Russian, "We want peace." Some designers went out of their way, making moving exhibitions in solidarity with the Ukrainians. During Paris Fashion Week, the fashion house Balenciaga left blue and yellow T-shirts on the seats of every showgoer, along with a heartfelt note from designer Dimna Vizelia, who became a refugee when he fled Georgia as a child. In Milan, Giorgio Armani turned off the music and had models walk in silence as a sign of respect to people in the unfolding tragedy. Ukrainian designer Dima Aivenko of the brand Ainki Inki found himself stranded in Italy just a day after he showed his fall-winter 2022 collection. In an interview with GQ, as he scrambled to help his 120 Kyiv-based employees, he said he felt that the industry wasn't doing enough to acknowledge the enormity of the situation. The largest country in Europe is under huge, violent attack from Russia, and still nobody knows and nobody cares. He had a point. The symbolic gestures of support were all taking place as luxury goods were largely left off of the EU's Russia sanctions. They were added a couple of weeks later. as NATO countries work to seize yachts and untangle the international holdings of Putin-enabling oligarchs, the glamorous mythology is being punctured before our eyes. And Western democracies are discovering that the call is coming from inside the house. When Evgeny Lebedev, with whom Perminova jokes about being his stepmother, even though he's several years older than her, was elevated to Britain's House of Lords in 2020 by Boris Johnson, despite reports that intelligence officials raised concerns that he might be a security risk, Lebedev posted a photo of himself in a crimson velvet robe, decorated with a white fur, on Instagram. "Music amongst the noblemen," the caption said, calling himself a muzhik, which is defined as a Russian peasant, was a bit of a stretch, but it was in keeping with the narrative that even the oligarchs like to attach to their personal biographies. A recent profile in Town and Country featured the headline, "The Dizzying Social Rise of Russian Scion Evgeny Lebedev." Asked whether he had intervened, Johnson denied it, arguing that the question suits Putin's agenda to try to characterize this as a struggle between the West and Russia. His answer, perhaps unintentionally, revealed how entangled Western democracies are in Putin's dirty money, how we've masked a sinister reality by telling ourselves these ridiculous fairy tales for way too long.
Thank you.
the Great Resistance. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has spawned death and horror, countered by a nationwide uprising that stands strong in the face of an increasingly dystopian war. With photographs by Alex Majoli, essay by Katya Petrovskaya. Opening photo, still standing. Fortifications surround Odessa's Opera House, an iconic landmark in the Black Sea city, as Russia's bloody war unfolds. As I write, 6 weeks have passed since the war began. We are starting to adjust. The death of a person becomes a statistic. It is impossible to adjust. We are watching the war online. The stories we encounter are emerging as if out of a ripped belly, multifaceted grief without hierarchy. They block any means of perception. How to bear it? The young woman from Mariupol who was rescuing others, killed. Wounded people. Huge halls in Poland filled with refugees and their pets. Children in Kharkiv living in the subway. The ghost buildings of Odessa, ruins everywhere. My writing cannot protect a single person under the bombs, a single house. The war is quicker than any speech against it. Today, I again woke up at 5:07 a.m. as if from an explosion or an air raid siren. The exact time the war started on February 24th. Each time, upon waking, I hope that this war is my personal nightmare. It takes a few seconds for evidence to break through. O is killed, M is killed, N is killed, A is killed. The skeletons of charred houses hurt me from the inside. I cannot grasp the war. I have to stop it. I am in Berlin, and thousands of people are arriving every day from Ukraine to the main railway station. They don't want to be called refugees. They are homeless, mostly women and children, the men left behind. Their future is uncertain. They are looking for the next step. The family from Mariupol was euphoric, still not believing that they were alive, in Europe, trying to feed me with everything that had just been donated to them. A very old man from a village near Zaporizhia held both my hands. His daughter did not want to leave, but forced him and her mother to go. A small girl from Kharkiv jumping around and saying, "Papa did this," or "Papa did that," her mother silent. That family from Hostomel, I had promised to help them, a father and his disabled son, but I forgot to come back and lost them in the crowd. Now, my mother, a child of World War II, has made it to Berlin. She taught history her whole life. Back in 1941, she, a six-year-old girl, had to leave Kyiv for the Urals, fleeing the German army. Now she has fled Kyiv for Germany, escaping the Russian army. It is perhaps the smallest absurdity of this war. Whatever I do, my thoughts are in Mariupol, a city that before the war was home to more than 400,000 inhabitants. I try to imagine so many people starving, under bombs, trying to flee, unable to bury their dead, bombed again, dying while I am writing, dying while Western leaders debate and hesitate. Mariupol already recalls the siege of Leningrad and the Battle of Stalingrad in one. We don't dare to imagine the scale of devastation caused by the Russian army, and yet we know enough to say that this army, trained in Grozny and Aleppo, now turns its atrocities on Ukraine, all of them, encyclopedically. A few weeks ago, I asked one high-ranking military expert, "How many dead civilians does the West need in order to start acting?" He said, "It might sound cynical, but we need pictures." Bucha, Irpin, Vorzel, a trio of small satellites around Kyiv. I saw the pictures at night, a palm and smashed faces peeking out from brown soil, the hand of a dead woman with a professional red manicure. a mass grave, some 300 bodies, others lying along the street with tied hands in fashionable shoes, tortured, shot. The street was newly repaved. Bucha had been getting richer. Lootings, reports of mass rape, the killing of whole families. My brain refuses to understand. My body goes through withdrawal. I went to Bucha in the summer as a child. In recent years, visiting Kyiv, I joined friends there. My university classmate Taras has a big family in Bucha. They all gather in summer on the lake to make huge pots of plov, to swim and to sing, to stroll through grass taller than we are. Friends of friends, musicians, kids, slightly hippie-like, one of the sweetest gatherings I ever experienced. Danila played bagpipes. I picture them all in my head at once and shiver. Taras wrote the next day, "His relatives are out of Bucha, spread across Europe, safe. The mother of one of my friends in Berlin is also safe after 2 weeks in a cellar in Bucha, discovering now, in the pace of everyday life, who is and is not alive among her neighbors. The violence is spreading everywhere where people just used to live, further, unpredictable. My friend, a photographer, met a woman in a village on the road to Kyiv. She was watching cars pass by, as if she were waiting for something. She had spent her life teaching Russian language and literature. Now she had lost her only son. Russian soldiers had taken a few men to repair their machinery, treated them politely, and then killed them all. Russia misuses Ukrainian war victims for propaganda in order to kill more people and to indulge further killing, justifying the newly killed as a premise to kill even more. Everything that does not help to break the pace of this war seems hollow to me. We know this dystopian nature of dictatorship. It reproduces death. How many times have we thought about what could have been done to stop Hitler, had one acted in time, had people believed in their own power and the need to resist for the sake of the others? Now we think of this war. It is too late to think in the subjunctive. Accepting our powerlessness, we accept their violence. From the first days, work became for many a method of resistance to war, became a proof of existence, since the mere idea of sovereign existence is questioned. Not just the Ukrainian army and territorial defense forces, the whole country is working like a beehive. Concrete support for people fighting, for people helping to help, that seems the ultimate choice. Perhaps this is a substitution for hope, to act. No normal life, only frenetic actions. It is not only because horror would swallow you if you were to stop. It is the decentralized initiative of survival. Next photos, the warpath. Ukrainians are pitching in to protect their country. Here, young volunteers move anti-tank barrages to the eastern entrance of Odessa in preparation for attacks. And a Russian missile strike on a military base in Mykolaiv claimed the lives of dozens of Ukrainian soldiers. People are creating new supply systems and information networks, organizing evacuations, cooking for the army, buying medicine and supplying those who remain in occupied zones, rescuing pets, and protecting monuments. This irrefutable enthusiasm reminds me of the Spanish Civil War. The chain of deeds in a common endeavor has spread across Europe and beyond, and I am also a part of it. There is no time to tell the stories, to tell others what we all are actually doing. For the first few weeks, we lived in a tempo of orders. There are thousands of such groups emerging sporadically. But there is so much grief that even helping all the time, you cannot heal the wounds. The war lasts, and multiplies calamities. This merciless knowledge inevitably makes witnesses out of us. I wonder, who is this we? We Ukrainians? We who live in Europe? Anyone who agrees that Putin has to be defeated by all means? We can admire those who are fighting, feel compassion with those who suffer. We who sometimes experience powerlessness. Others can pretend that this war has nothing to do with them. But the Russian war has already changed the order of things, exposed the vulnerability of the most powerful world organizations. The war could be stopped by a common act of resistance. But so much depends nowadays on how we define this we, expanding it beyond the institutions and methods that have proven themselves insufficient. Spring has come, and people's wish to return to Ukraine grows even stronger. My mom, my friends, people I met at Berlin's train station, so many want to go home, even if there is no home left. I could never have expected that our life would once turn as simple as a folk song, to chase away the enemy, to reunite with loved ones, to touch the soil, to enter the apartment, to plant, to mourn, to see the orchards blossoming, to go back to work, to rebuild, or just to visit the place you came from. Simple, hardly reachable things. And ending photos, firing line. Volunteers in Odessa receive training in firearms as Russia's full-scale invasion grows. Last rites. Sergei Belgorodov, 29, is laid to rest following an attack on the military base of Voznesky. And safe haven. Millions of people, many of them children, have fled Ukraine since Russia invaded, with more displaced inside the country. up to their eyeballs. Anxious about the crowded marketplace, the streamers are going after network TV's dwindling audience, and it's changing what shows get made, by Joy Press. With illustrations by Derek Abella, opening illustration shows a mechanical arm reaching for eyeballs. It's apparently time to ask how long the golden age can stay golden. All those weird little shows that streaming executives used to want to take a risk on a few years ago is just not happening anymore, says a writer who specializes in prestige television. You have to find ways to Trojan horse that into big blockbuster genre projects that they will greenlight, because if you front-load a pitch with anything that feels too boundary-pushing these days, it's just an automatic no. Wasn't streaming supposed to be a wild new frontier of no-rules TV? Taboos broken, formats melted, and recombined, artist let off the leash? The reality is more complicated. Since streamers came to dominate the landscape, the assumption has been that broadcast TV is seriously endangered, that it's struggling to reach new generations of viewers, partly because of its risk-averse rules and its devotion to broad, inoffensive content. That existential threat is real, but some see a worrisome irony emerging. The streamers are acting more and more like the cautious industry they revolutionized. Streamers are pursuing what they call elevated broadcast, making sitcoms, dramas, procedurals, and reality TV central to their platforms. Some also appear to be pulling back from the challenging content that attracted audiences in hopes of scooping up every viewer the networks have left. Insiders say streaming executives are becoming less adventurous, or more populist, depending on your point of view, because they're spooked by the overcrowded market and uncertain about how to keep expanding and retaining their subscriber bases. Recently, Netflix's stock price plunged after an earnings report projected a loss of 2 million global subscribers by June. A top executive there also said that they are exploring a lower-priced subscription that would include commercials. I'm always a little bit worried that half the streamers will go away at a certain point, says Alan Yang, co-creator of unconventional comedies like Netflix's Makers of None. Master of None, Amazon's Forever, and Apple TV Plus's upcoming Loot. Can the market sustain all of them spending the way they are and making the number of shows that they make? Netflix now abounds in escapist fare a la Emily in Paris and Love is Blind. Amazon, famously the home of Transparent and Fleabag, dedicates an immense amount of money to epics like The Wheel of Time and The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Paramount Plus is building a universe around Taylor Sheridan, creator of the Western megahit Yellowstone, and Peacock is betting on pop culture reboots to reel in both the nostalgic older audience and younger viewers who respond to tried and true templates. I hear this panic around the idea that some of these streamers are not going to exist in 3 years, and people get very conservative when that happens, says a showrunner. There's a real directive to agents and writers to broaden the appeal, which is crazily disheartening. Next illustration shows a trophy with an eyeball at the top. The streaming industry pumps a staggering amount of content into our homes, including series in many languages, because the platforms have executives around the world commissioning shows designed to appeal to local audiences. So the concern is not that a drought of edgy, challenging content will arrive tomorrow. It's more that the age of audacious streaming shows may be winding down. Are we not still in that golden moment? Is that over already? Says Netflix's global head of TV, Bella Bajaria, smiling broadly. I don't believe streaming is becoming network. We just have so many different kinds of shows that can be in so many different tones and formats. I look at shows on our slate that were really bold and distinct, like The Queen's Gambit, Maid, Squid Game. Those things really resonated with an audience, too. Bajaria spent much of her career at CBS and Universal Studios, creating network and later streaming shows, and championing series like The Mindy Project and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt that drew outside conventional lines. She acknowledges that there's a place on the streamer for shows that want to bring absolutely everyone into the tent, and points to the post-apocalyptic fantasy series Sweet Tooth as an example. I agree that elevated broadcast is a thing. One industry insider says that Shonda Rhimes' Bridgerton was a particular game changer. I know that there's a real push at Netflix to make other shows into that elevated broadcast sensibility because of its success, says the source. Once the crown jewel of ABC, Rhimes knows how to create seductive, boundary-pushing hits. But she jumped at the chance to experiment with the costume drama genre inside the streaming format. What was cool that we could do on Netflix is tell a closed-ended tale. Here's this season, here's a fully formed romance, Rhimes told Vanity Fair last year. On network, you have to take that romance and stretch it out for as many seasons as you possibly can, and keep coming up with reasons why they're having a new conflict. Network shows also have a fixed number of episodes per season, and episodes have a set number of minutes. Potential series are tested via pilot episodes. Shows are designed around advertising breaks and are expected to be widely appealing and uncontroversial. The word vajayjay became popularized after it was used in Rhimes' own Grey's Anatomy in order to get around ABC's standards and practices executives. Who wouldn't let a fictional doctor say vagina? Creating a hit network series once represented the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for creatives working in television, with their giant syndication deals that could set you up for life. Everybody dreamed of making the next Friends or Modern Family. And now, there's still a lot of money to be made in broadcast, one insider says, but the majority of creators don't want to be working there if they don't have to. An executive producer recently hesitated to take a network gig. I felt it would actually be damaging to my career if I had this credit on my resume, especially because I've spent the last few years not doing that so I could have streaming credits. Another showrunner talked about the extra income from network shows, which usually have more episodes than streaming shows, as a distaste bonus. Young viewers do still watch network shows, not just classics like The Office, but new breakout hits like ABC's Abbott Elementary, except that they're often watching them on streaming platforms. I have a soul-crushing example of that, says an exec named George Cheeks. His teenage nephew recently told him that his new favorite show was a comedy called Ghost, about a young couple who inherit a haunted house. Cheeks pointed out that it was on CBS, to which his nephew replied, "What's CBS?" Cheeks burst out laughing as he recalls the conversation. "I am the CEO of CBS," he says. But he's only seen it in streaming and had no idea that it actually existed on a broadcast network. The big four broadcast networks all have streamers of their own now, which allows them to capture more youthful viewers. Cheeks, who also oversees Paramount Plus, says the average age of people watching Survivor on CBS is 60, and 37 for those streaming it on Paramount Plus. He sees this as a good thing, saying, "We are reaching that unduplicated younger audience in streaming." If broadcast viewers are quickly approaching retirement, though, why don't networks just focus all their energies on their streamers? Prepare to be shocked. Money. A 30-second spot run during a popular broadcast show can still bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars. The economics of streaming are trickier, with a constant risk that subscribers will binge a favorite show and then cancel. So media companies are determined to wring every last drop out of broadcast, even as ratings continue to shrink. What was 25 million viewers became 18 million viewers, which is now like 7 million viewers, says a showrunner. But networks don't change the model because they're afraid to alienate the people that they have. Whatever they say about network TV, though, streaming executives are now devoted to replicating its successes because they feel a pressure to be all things to all people, to be superstores of programming. So Netflix has created extremely popular competition shows. Hulu has scooped up the Kardashians, and Amazon, immediately upon buying James Bond's parent company, MGM, greenlighted a global competition called 007's Road to a Million. There are sure to be more developments like this, since unscripted fare costs less than premium drama. There's a high level of audience engagement in the elimination shows, says Channing Dungey, the chairwoman and CEO of Warner Brothers Television Studios. So, if some shows that promote engagement can be made at unscripted dollar prices, you're doing really well. Even live TV has come to the streamers. Live has been a big part of our streaming strategy, whether it's sporting events that we have on ESPN Plus or the live TV service that we have as part of Hulu, says Disney streaming president Michael Paul. Disney Plus hosted its first live-streamed event in February, the 94th Academy Awards nominations. Increasingly, streamers are even rethinking one of their most lifestyle-altering inventions, the binge. Instead of dropping an entire series all at once, they're rationing out episodes weekly, as in days of yore, so that viewers have time to digest and buzz about each one. One television writer says his teenagers didn't even understand the concept of appointment TV until the addictive euphoria began streaming on HBO Max. Now they watch it live en masse. The notion that streamers are seeking elevated broadcast makes Susan Rovner chuckle. She's the chair of entertainment content for NBC Universal Television and Streaming, overseeing NBC's broadcast network, cable channels, and its two-year-old streaming service, Peacock. I love hearing that, she says. Definitely that applies to Peacock. Rovner, along with Frances Berwick, NBC Universal chairwoman of Entertainment Networks, is in charge of NBC Universal's whole television landscape, so she can find a home for a variety of content. There are some shows that are smaller and a bit more niche that we're really proud of and we absolutely love, but we are definitely taking some big swings on shows with that broad appeal, she says. Name-checking Bel-Air, Peacock's reboot of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. On the other hand, Joe vs. Carol, a scripted take on the duo made infamous by the Netflix docuseries Tiger King, was initially supposed to be shared between NBC, USA, and Peacock. As we got into the development of the story, says Rovner, it was very clear the content would be watered down if it stayed on NBC. The network-streamer relationship is similarly symbiotic for Craig Erwich, who oversees both Hulu and ABC's broadcast programming. Shows like The Rookie and The Good Doctor air on ABC's broadcast schedule, and then hours later, they're available on Hulu. So right off the bat, we have elevated broadcast television on Hulu. That leaves room for more niche programming made expressly for the streamers. Shows that have a very dedicated fan base, that don't have to be for everybody, like the irreverent auteurish Rami. Hulu also has the benefit of streaming content from FX, the high-end cable network behind Atlanta and Better Things. It would be a savage irony if streaming, so long a haven for surprising and sometimes disturbing visions, evolved into a younger version of the networks. This scenario is still a ways off, to be clear. Amazon's Small Axe, Apple TV Plus's Severance, and HBO Max's Station 11 would all be unimaginable on a conventional network. But can platforms under financial pressure in an increasingly competitive marketplace continue to support this kind of work? Or will only a small number of privileged creators with overall deals be allowed to make work that doesn't slot into the four-quadrant formula? Dungy points to HBO's Euphoria as proof that there's room for dark, edgy material on TV, but says she does see a shift at Netflix, where she was previously an executive. They came out of the gate really looking to sort of zig where everybody else was zagging, and I think that they have been moving a little bit more toward the mainstream in some of their choices. Netflix, which relies heavily on mysterious internal metrics, has upset some fans and showrunners by unceremoniously canceling some unorthodox shows. Rachel Schuchert's critically beloved series about preteen girls, The Babysitter's Club, was canned after two seasons. Recently, Schuchert told Vulture that when she started working at Netflix in 2016 on the series Glow, it was okay to have a smaller audience and be quirkier or more particular. The philosophy was to support talented creators and trust their projects will find an audience. As they've grown, I think that philosophy has changed somewhat. Something that was fine 3 months ago is suddenly not what they need. Here's hoping there remains a place for everything under the sun, especially now that we've all had a glimpse of what's possible. Streamers did make a lot of stuff that no one was watching, but it was beautiful, says Master of Nuns, Alan Yang. He pauses thoughtfully. I say that in the past tense, because the winds might be changing. Ultimately, the executives need eyeballs on their stuff. Additional reporting for this article by Chris Murphy. full bloom. Need someone to bring your blockbuster book to life? Just give Daisy Edgar Jones a call, as interviewed by Brett Hinemuth. When Normal People arrived on Hulu in 2020, the adaptation of Sally Rooney's novel made a star of Daisy Edgar Jones. The actor and avid reader has continued bringing more beloved books to the screen, including Under the Banner of Heaven and Where the Crawdads Sing. In the meantime, there's Sundance Darling Fresh, a comedy with a cannibalistic twist. Edgar Jones reflects on her whirlwind rise and what chapters may lie ahead. The only child of a film editor mother and television executive father, Edgar Jones fell for acting during a primary school play about Henry VIII. She played Anne Boleyn. After 4 years in small TV parts, she landed Normal People. Co-star Paul Mescal will always be one of my best friends. We were terrified, and we really held each other through that experience. Actually, we just went to Coachella together. She'll never forget filming Fresh's more gruesome scenes. You want to have a shot of my bare arse on the operating table? That was the weirdest professional discussion I've ever had. Reading the zany script, she remembers thinking, this could go really wrong, but do you know what? This is my 20s. I want this to be a time for learning. Honoring her character in FX's Under the Banner of Heaven, a murder victim, was crucial. Brenda's family is still alive, and we have an opportunity to share her life. As pageant queen Brenda, the actor also performs the rose on screen. Bette Midler, man, it's quite a tricky song. As a fan of Delia Owens' book, Edgar Jones braved lightning, floods, gators, and cockroaches filming Crawdads in New Orleans. I kept thinking, this is the scene in the book where, and then going, oh my God, but we only have 20 minutes to film it. Up next, she's looking for a summer project, adjusting to Hollywood. It's surreal to be in a room with people you've been watching all your life. You feel like you stepped inside the telly. And hoping to get a call from Wes Anderson. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via a special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.